Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston CA. Defining masculinity in America might seem to be a relatively straightforward matter. It is not. The meaning of maleness has been one of the most fiercely argued topics in American society, with periodic eruptions of the debate emerging at key points of our history. And even when the subject was not in public contention, it roiled beneath the surface of seemingly placid waters. Which brings us to the 1950s. During that lauded but little understood decade, much was in flux in American society, and the nature of real manliness was profoundly in play. To know what really was happening to men in that deceptively calm but absolutely pivotal period provides real insight into an evolving America, then and now. My guest is James Gilbert, professor of history at the University of Maryland and author of Men in the Middle, Searching for Masculinity in the 1950s. Jim Gilbert, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Good to have you here, Jim. And for those of us who were men or boys in the 1950s, there's a great deal in this book that is memorable, but much, much more that's revelatory of things that I personally had not even realized were going on. Let me take as a starting point this observation of mine, Jim, to see if you agree with it. I was struck throughout this book by an undercurrent of curiosity on the part of the American people about their changing nature. And to cite what I think might be an example of that, and I'd love your comment on it, the fact that you had relatively serious books like The Lonely Crowd, The Organization Man, and of course, The Kinsey Report as bestsellers. It seems to me people were, beneath all that golf-playing placidity, really wondering what they were like.
I agree with you. I think that the 50s is a remarkable period precisely for the bestsellers that are totally unexpected. I think if a reader were to pick up The Lonely Crowd today, which is not that long a book, but very difficult to read, and I can tell you that for sure because I used to assign it to my students, and they wouldn't read it. They just simply refused to do it, or they would read the first couple of pages. These books were widely sold, and I think they were even read, actually.
They were, yeah.
And people commented on them, and words like The Lonely Crowd, The Organization Man became not just titles, but they became words in our everyday vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think, Jim, and this goes, I think, largely to the heart of your book and the question of what masculinity would mean. Why that seriousness? Why that concern about books like this, thoughts like this, new ideas or trends or these things? I mean, because this is not usual behavior.
I think the 50s is a very interesting period. I think that the sense of change and the sense of living in a new world is quite extraordinary, and that coincides with a number of other things. One is the prominence of public intellectuals in the 1950s. We have a lot of pundits and people who belong to think tanks, but we don't really have public intellectuals in the sense that the 50s had them anymore. And these people were very prominent, very famous, and listened to. Yeah. And there was a lot of respect for people like that. It's also more of a print culture in the 50s than it is today. And the dialogue about ourselves takes place not as much on television, obviously, as it did in print media. So those two reasons have a lot to do with, I think, the fact that that these books were popular. In addition to the fact that they were really remarkable books, soul-searching books, coming out of newly prestigious sociology and psychology and so on. So a lot of things come together to make these books famous.
Exactly. Against all of that, Jim Gilbert, why is the debate about masculinity, which, as you point out in your book, resurfaces at this time, why does it do so? And also, why is it so important an argument? I mean, what is its importance to the society that we talk about, what men are like?
I think the issue of masculinity is always important in American life, particularly because up until this period and including this period, when we talk about Americans or individuals or the sort of man in the street, it's always a man. if we look back at the frontier and the great formative experience of American of the American character, we're talking about men. We're not talking about women.
So this definition of men, if I understand you, Jim, this need to define men is, in a sense, a need to define the country.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And people are understanding, beginning to understand, that that's a very strange way of looking at things, that it leaves out more than half the population.
Right.
And it overlooks women and, in fact, often casts women as villains in American history.
It does that, and your book is very, very powerful on this point. It certainly overlooks women and even overlooks a lot of men because it's, as I understood, it's kind of a white, middle-class male that
it
we're
is,
talking about here.
It is, and it's only some of them.
And only some of them, right. But they have a powerful, obviously a very powerful effect about what the rest of the people.
Yes, I think there's a coincidence of American individualism and masculinity that is a powerful metaphor and myth in American history. Yeah. And the 1950s plays this out, of course. I mean, this is the heyday of John Wayne, and John Wayne makes scores of films, and he seems to be the prototypical American. But when I think about the 1950s, I think, yes, John Wayne, absolutely, it's all true. But my God, what about Tennessee Williams? And why was Tennessee Williams so popular in the 1950s?
Yeah, this is one of the strengths of this book. There are several individuals we're going to talk about who are depicted here and their influence on the decade. But I'm moved to ask you this, Jim. The ghost at the feast of masculinity, if I can use that expression, Jim, perhaps throughout our national, or the world's history for that matter, but certainly it seems to me coming to a very prominent head in the 1950s is homosexuality, I think. I mean, it seems to me that among the challenges the masculinity is wrestling with in the 50s are the rise of women, changes in pattern of consumption, communists at the gate, etc., but also this fear of homosexuals as a group perhaps getting too visible, getting more power, becoming too evident.
I think that's true. I think it's a kind of defining difference to some degree, and the prominence of homosexuals in the media makes it that much more striking. I don't think that the 1950s is a particularly liberal period in terms of homosexuals. In fact, there's a horrible pink panic in Washington in the early 50s in which homosexuals are fired from federal service for the fear that they might be blackmailed and fired. I mean, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in a certain sense. So it's a terrible period in some ways. But at the same time, the issue is opening up again, and it's important in Kinsey's discoveries of male behavior, and it's important in terms of culture and cultural expression.
Which I think, as a reader, I was very grateful to you, as we discussed this and other points, for using, as we'll now turn to, the individuals such as Alfred Kinsey, Billy Graham, and Tennessee Williams, to not just as archetypes of this or that, but as kind of staters of different philosophies and views and perspectives on these things. Let me take a moment from our conversation and we'll turn to those people and what they said as we counted in your book, Jim. But let me remind our listeners at this point that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. And my guest is James Gilbert, who's author of Men in the Middle. You know, I could probably make this comment and ask this question at any point in our conversation. I think I'll make it now and then have you respond to it and perhaps even respond to it again at the end. But my overall impression of this book, Jim, and I think it's one of the points that, unless I got entirely wrong, that you really wanted to make people aware of, was that it's simplistic to view this as simply a fight over archetypes, if you will, of you know what the manly man himself may be. But to see that decade as doing something that may still be ongoing, and that is, quote, and perhaps in the person of Tennessee Williams will really see this, but presenting a range of possibilities of male expression and a kind of a spectrum, if you will, of ways of being male. And that spectrum, at least, still exists. Is that
Absolutely. That is exactly the point, that the 1950s, when you look beneath the surface, is a time when more and more possibilities were opening up for the sort of standard mainline expression of masculinity. You didn't necessarily have to be John Wayne. Mm-hmm. Of course, you couldn't be John Wayne. Nobody could be John Wayne except John Wayne.
And he wasn't John Wayne, really.
And that's true. Yeah. Uh-huh. So I think that's always often been a tension in American society, mm-hmm. the difference between the sort of prevailing archetype and the undercurrent of changes that are going on, and the presentation of different kinds of perspectives. Right. But the 50s is poignant because of that, it seems to me.
Yeah. Alfred Kinsey, whose name is still known to so many, maybe practically everyone in this country, and I like the way you titled this chapter, he wrote a report that, quote, shook the world. Indeed he did. Shook America, too. And there's lots to be said about it, but let me see if we can cut to at least one of the chases, and that is that it seems to me that one of his bottom lines that most surprised the country, and I think surprise is the word, is that when people ask what's normal, his response would be, the normal is this very extensive range of sexual behavior that I'm depicting here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not all, mom and pop. And
Kinsey did two things. He found a way of asking questions to people that revealed their sexual behavior. He got mm-hmm. people to talk frankly about their experience. And the way he presented it is what is controversial and interesting, because people always knew that there was a range of sexual expression. They always knew that behavior varied. But almost everybody who wrote about sexual behavior wrote about it from a normative point of view. This is good, this is bad, this is normal, this is abnormal. And the abnormal was the bad.
Right.
And so there's a heavy dose of moralism and a kind of standardization in a lot of sexual dialogue that goes up to the late 1930s. Kinsey treated behavior as in the way that he treated the gall wasp, which is what he's a great expert in. He did a taxonomy of behavior. And when it came to writing it up, mm-hmm. He believed that all behavior should be considered on the same graph, mm-hmm. that there were no distinctions between behaviors. One form of behavior was just a variant of another form of behavior. So you put them all on the same graph, mm-hmm. and you didn't keep a piece of it aside and say, well, that's abnormal, that's bad.
Right.
And that was what was truly shocking, because these graphs that he wrote, that he constructed in his book, were really pictures, and they became pictures of behavior.
Yeah.
And one of the things you could do if you read this book was find yourself somewhere. You could find yourself on the graph.
Right. And I was struck by the fact that people would do that. They would try to find themselves on the graph, and then even if they couldn't, or when they couldn't, they would write him, and he played a very powerful role as kind of a very, very, he responded to everything.
The amazing thing about Kinsey's very opposed to Freudianism. He thinks mm-hmm. that Freudianism is a normative science, or at least in its American version. And yet, he thinks of himself as a kind of a therapist. With his correspondence, people would write him a letter and say, "Oh my God, you know, my wife is asking me to do this, and I don't know whether I should do this. This seems absolutely wrong to me." And Kinsey would write back and say, "Well, look on page 465, yeah. and you'll see that 40% of Americans do this."
Yeah.
And so the statistical description was in fact a normative description, and so if there was any percentage, it was part of the normal.
Hmm. One of the things we might say is that, or it seemed to me that, among the many effects, and there were powerful effects, disturbing and perhaps liberating in the same measure, of the Kinsey report and his activity, was its influence on. I'll cite a particular name and a phenomenon: people like Hugh Hefner. And the invention of Playboy and all that represented in this debate about masculinity.
Yes, Hugh Hefner was a smart guy, and I'm not sure that this is not an apocryphal story, but the story is that he read Kinsey and suddenly saw a market, because mm-hmm. Kinsey Kinsey talked about the middle class men. He made some class differences in his descriptions, and he found that middle class men did not go to prostitutes and had had rather later sexual act initiation than working class men. And that meant that their sexual life was fantasy life. Mm-hmm. And Hugh Hefner read that and said, "Ah, I can create a magazine designed mm-hmm. for middle class college boys right. that appeals to their fantasy life."
And create he did, with the effect we've all seen. Turning to a very different person and a very different question, and the fact that the people we're talking about coexisted and were active at the same time is itself quite phenomenal. The book depicts Billy Graham. Still, I think he may have made his last sermon, but he's certainly still on the scene. And he was a very powerful figure in the 50s, and a young, virile, and that may be a very important point, evangelist who one could say was both the medium and the model for his own message. I mean, his persona, he seems to have projected as the essence of, and here we'll use a phrase from maybe the 19th century, muscular Christianity. But all, I got the impression, Jim Gilbert, in the hope of attracting more male converts to
yes.
religion.
Billy Graham is a very, very interesting interesting person, and I thought a lot about him, particularly because this is in some ways his heyday.
Mm-hmm.
The early years of Billy Graham, with the Great Crusades in London and New York and so on, is where he really captured the attention of the media and later television. He's a remarkable person, and he faces like a lot of Protestant evangelicals, and in fact religious people in general. He faces the problem of getting male converts. Almost universally, this is true in American mm-hmm. religion, that churches are full of women and that men are less likely to go. They're more reluctant.
Mm-hmm.
And Graham was fascinated by the problem and wasn't content just to say, "I want more men." He did things about it. He would hold special... prayer sessions for Wall Street lawyers,
right?
And during his crusades, and he would set aside men's groups. And now this is typical. Dwight Moody did it in the 1890s,
right.
And so in that sense, it's part of the tradition. And in some respects, Graham is a very traditional character, mm-hmm. but he also made some movies about male conversion, and I concentrate on those, and I think these mm-hmm. are wonderful films. They were made in Hollywood
mm-hmm.
By a movie studio that now still exists. It's called Worldwide Pictures today, and occasionally we'll do a movie that makes it into theaters.
Right.
But this was the beginning of it,
mm-hmm.
All of the first movies he made are the same movie, basically. They're about some tough, inarticulate guy.
Who faces a crisis,
who's very, very masculine, but can't bring himself to mm-hmm. accept this kind of feminine quality of religion. And the film is about that movement of this man mm-hmm. to conversion. And
yeah.
It's very interesting.
The next person treated, I have only to say the name Ozzie Nelson, and that will generate, I'm sure, all kinds of recollections, not only among people who lived through the first Ozzie and Harriet series, or even the preceding one on the radio, but even now, Ozzie and Harriet as a phrase, I think, has some resonance still in the society. And a lot can be said about it, but I thought one of the more interesting things that you said, Jim Gilbert, was that, first of all, this whole sitcom series, Ozzie and Harriet, revolves around what we might call the newly domesticated male of the 1950s. This is the house husband now, in a sense, in the suburb and doing things that are new expressions of men in life. But it had a kind of, here's the word, I think I encountered this word in the chapter on him that I thought was very interesting, almost therapeutic effect on the viewing population, perhaps the male population. How would you assess? What did it amount to, really?
Well, Ozzie's a fascinating character because almost inevitably in the beginning of the show, Ozzie will say, well, in the good old days, a man was a man, and mm-hmm. my father always told me that I was supposed to do this, mm-hmm. and women aren't as smart as men. They can't make decisions. They don't know how to do home repairs. And there's a litany of things that women can't do and that men can do. Mm-hmm. Well, inevitably, in every one of these shows, these old patriarchal values fall flat on their face, and so does Ozzie. and Ozzie learns a lesson. He learns that he was wrong. Mm-hmm. And in the end of the show, he comes around and sort of, in a comedy way, accepts the equality of women and the wisdom of children, mm-hmm. and the new world that he lives in. And then, of course, the next show, he starts out the same way.
Right.
And so it's a show that makes no advance whatsoever. Nothing changes. Ozzie is always unconverted, and he's always wrong, and he's always bumbling. And the show is about him.
Yeah.
It's not about Harriet. And it's and in the early days, it's not really about the kids.
Right.
Ozzie's the instigator. Now, what's happened is that this is a great model. It's a great model for a situation comedy. And you see it everywhere today on television, although the Ozzie character has changed. And it's generally not a middle-class person. It's now generally a poorer person, a working-class person. And usually the person today is cruder, more mm-hmm. vulgar, more belligerent, mm-hmm. But the dynamic is the same.
Each one of the people we've talked about, Jim, has brought forth a powerfully important perspective of masculinity or interpretation of it. But the one we're going to discuss now, the last person treated in the book, I thought the most fascinating, and that's Tennessee Williams. And one of the unknown things in this book that, unknown to me, that is, that I learned, was that there was a correspondence between Tennessee Williams and Alfred Kinsey, which I don't even know what it was about, but that just the fact that they were in contact strikes me as interesting.
Exactly. Well, Kinsey wanted to... Wanted to interview all the players in one of Tennessee Williams' plays, actors, mm-hmm. to see how playing a role would affect their sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. And so Kinsey, ever the investigator, is trying to get involved in that. But Williams is a major character in mm-hmm. the 1950s, and probably the leading playwright of the era. Although maybe Arthur Miller is more important in some respects. But Williams makes it to Hollywood. And so most of his plays become Hollywood plays. And they attract a coterie of wonderful actors and actresses mm-hmm. who sometimes make that transition from Broadway to Hollywood via his plays. And at other times, they are simply of an acting school that that he employed. So you get Marlon Brando and Montgomery Clift and Deborah Carr and the great actors, Paul Newman, Burl Ives, great actors who play in these roles. And the films are widely seen, and they all are ambiguous about sexuality, and they
yeah.
express sexuality in such different ways.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's a behind-the-scenes aspect in your treatment of Tennessee Williams and the phenomena. Because he was a homosexual, I think.
Although he tries to closet it. But, of course, everybody knows about it, sure.
One of the great, known secrets,
exactly.
you will.
Exactly.
But he has, there's kind of ambivalence is not the word, but he has a lot of trouble getting that message out. I mean, the way he wants to... very delicately, if you will, treat certain characterizations that and maybe because he feels he can't get away with it, but you know, he's kind of caught up in that. I can't say this.
I
dilemma
think
as much
so.
As anyone else.
And one of the things that results from that is because you can't say things openly. You say things circuitously, and they become more complicated and ultimately far more interesting. And so to some degree, the reticence.
Well, like the use of mendacity.
Yes.
And Cat on a Hat Tin Roof, right? That's an example.
Exactly. Mendacity is the word that Burl Ives uses, Big Daddy, in this wonderful play, mm-hmm. And wonderful, equally wonderful, all the different movie. Mendacity is the code word for all the lies that we tell about ourselves. And in the end of this play, it's obvious that mendacity is the only way we can get along.
Yeah.
And the transition from mendacity as a critique of human behavior, mm-hmm. to the thing that makes it work, mm-hmm. is so fascinating. And I think that is very autobiographical. Yeah, if you think about Tennessee Williams sort of lying but not lying about who he is. Mm-hmm. So identity itself is mendacity. And identity is individually and socially constructed, and that's what he's arguing in this play.
It's a marvelous point as we come to the conclusion of our conversation, Jim Gilbert. And as we conclude it, and to play on this same theme of Tennessee Williams, because he also gives us that very marvelous spectrum of male types, ranging from Stanley Kowalski all the way through to the tortured Rick Pollitt and many stops in between. And to use a line from his world and just kind of characterize this range of possibilities, do you think, Jim Gilbert, that, as Tennessee Williams might have put it, masculinity at the end of the day is a kind of a role to be played?
Well, do I personally think that?
Yes.
Well, I think...
I mean, among many, I mean, you could choose the role the role that you want to play.
Yes, to some degree, I think it absolutely is. Mm-hmm. And Williams is right in that sense. Now, can we choose?
Mm.
Can we choose? That's another matter.
Mm-hmm.
It may be a role, but we may not be able to choose it.
Yeah.
And in other words, things may not be as open to us as we think they are. But looking at the spectrum of society, looking at all of the choices that people make, and the way in which masculinity is expressed, it seems to me that it's a form of behavior for which there isn't any really prescribed set of guides. But a series of possibilities.
Very well said, Jim Gilbert. The book is Men in the Middle. The author is Jim Gilbert, who's been my guest today. And thank you very much for the book, Jim, and for the conversation.
Thank you.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was James Gilbert, author of Men in the Middle. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.